Daniel chapter 3, if you would, in your Bibles, please. Daniel chapter 3. A long passage, but not as long as last week's. Again, we're still in the story half of the book of Daniel. These are stories that you've heard. These are stories that you've probably taught. Nothing that we talk about this morning will be new, but hopefully we'll hear it with new ears, fresh ears. We'll see it through fresh eyes. Daniel chapter 3. We're going to read it because part of the power of the passage is the layout of the passage. We're going to read through several lists. And part of the power of those lists, even though it seems less than powerful, but the power of those lists is kind of a mockery of the mechanistic way worship unfolds apart from a living relationship with God. Daniel chapter 3. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 8. Therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have set up, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Ah, something's different. Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of the image of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from them, limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Well, much is revealed by how we answer certain questions. Certain questions like, what would you do with $1 million given the opportunity? What would be your priorities? What would be your non-priorities? Same idea is found in the fairy book tales. What would you do if you had three wishes? What would they be? Or we go to the 1980s, back to the old commercials. What would you do for a Klondike bar, right? These answers are very revealing. What would you do given the opportunity? We come down to this passage, and the question is very obvious and very stark in front of us. What would it take for you to deny your God? I want you to think about that for just a minute. What would it take for you, not your neighbor, not your spouse, not your children, what would it take for you to deny your God? Suppose you were one of these three young Jews. How would you finish the sentence? "I will be faithful to my God unless," what? Unless financial pressure comes, the threat of losing my job, my house, my investments. Maybe I'll just tweak my tax return just a little bit so that, is that worth it to you? "I'll be faithful to God unless I have social pressures that come into my life. I'll follow him so long as I'm not mocked, I'm not excluded, I'm not demoted, I'm not shamed, I'm not lonely. I'll follow God unless I have family pressures. I'll follow God as long as my wife and my children are never brought into danger. I'll follow God as long as I don't have physical pressure, as long as I'm not subjected to extreme sickness, pain, or torture." But frequently, we as Americans at least, are exposed by a different question. What would it take for me actually to step out in faith to Christ? What would it take for me to follow God? And very often we find that we answer those. You know, if I have the financial security, then I'll follow God. If I'm guaranteed a certain standard of living, a certain amount of vacation days, certain retirement funds, and a stable economy, then I'll follow God. don't ask me to go to a third world country. That just doesn't make sense. That's not who I am. That's not the kind of person that I am. We'll follow God as long as we're guaranteed social success. We have the guarantee of friends, opportunities for career growth, certain level of influences. We'll follow God so long as we have the guarantee of family nearby, the right school, the right neighborhood, the right size of house. We'll follow God as long as we have the guarantee of physical comfort, running water, healthy working conditions, heating, air conditioning. Allow me to ask you an important question this morning. How are you evidencing faith as a follower of the living God? What does faith look like in your life? Where's there a cost? Where's there a tension? Where is there obedience without the promise of blessing or reward? Where are you evidencing faith as a follower of the living God? We can maybe ask the question a little bit differently. Where are you refusing to worship that which the world bows down to? You see the world around you bowing down to the God of success. Where are you willing to forfeit success in order to follow your God? You see the world around you bowing down at the foot of politics. Where are you willing to forfeit politics in order to follow your God? Where are you obeying in spite of the consequences, not because of the consequences? As we've said many times before, worship is the most important thing that we can do. But this morning's text drives the point home a little deeper. Worship is the most important thing that we can do because worship is nothing less than a matter of life and death. That's why Israel is where they are in this book, right? They're in captivity as a result of their way of worship. The fact that they refused to worship the one true living God and chose to substitute Him for that which they thought would bring them security and pleasure, that which bought them social graces within the community so that they could fit in, brought them death. And not, if not in a physical manner, at least in this spiritual manner, in bringing them into captivity in a foreign land. What I'd like to convince you this morning is this, that worship is nothing less than a matter of life and death. And I want us to see again, the book of Daniel is crafted so magnificently, you don't have to scratch the surface very hard to see what the main point of each of these chapters is. Let's look at how the text highlights its main points here. We see at the beginning that a royal decree is given to all peoples, nations, and languages. We see that there in verse 4. The herald proclaims, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, bow or burn." At the very end of this passage, we see down in, what is it, verse 29. "Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language must not say anything against the God of these men." So we have, enveloping this whole story, a decree that goes out from the king. It goes out to all peoples there in Babylon. Secondly, we have three Jews are standing accused. That's the tension of the story, right? Certain Chaldeans come in and they make accusations against them. What's going to happen? Well, we find out at the end that these three Jews are standing delivered. That they walk out of the fire, that it has no power over their bodies. They are not hurt by the fire. Number three, we see an enraged king giving orders. "Bring them to me now." Then on the other side of the very middle of the section, he says, "Heat up that furnace now. Bind them and throw them in." That means that at the very center of this story, we find three Jews standing with their God. And that's kind of the point, right, of the story. It's because they stand with their God that later they stand delivered. It's because they stand with their God in opposition to the decree to worship Babylon's gods that King Nebuchadnezzar says, don't you speak against their God. This is the turning point of the whole story, and so everything is structured in this way. But as we walk through this text, we're going to walk through seven reasons why we must learn to worship well. And again, we're going to kind of skip the stone quickly because this is where we're going this morning. I don't want to mishandle the text by running through it too quickly, but you know the story. You're familiar with this story. As we're given this royal decree to all the peoples, we find that we must learn to worship well because there's a primal inclination towards self-glory. Remember, as this is taking place, where this is taking place. This is taking place in Babylon. Babylon is the same place that the Tower of Babel was built way back in Genesis chapter 11. And this chapter in particular is going to parallel Genesis chapter 11 profoundly. Profoundly. Here we have a towering image. Verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 90 feet and its breadth was 9 feet. You couldn't miss this thing. Kind of an obelisk, kind of a pillar. It wasn't in proportion to a man, per se, the whole way up, but probably a person on top of a gigantic pillar on top of a podium, if you will, or a platform. But it stood some 90 feet in the air. It was almost 10 feet wide. You couldn't miss this puppy if you wanted to. It's a tower erected in Babel. It's 10 meters smaller than the Colossus of Rhodes, okay, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It's only 10 meters smaller than that Colossus on the Isle of Rhodes. This is a towering image. It's made by King Nebuchadnezzar, and it's made of gold, probably not solid gold, but probably covered with gold. But remember, as Nebuchadnezzar is told in chapter 2, he is the head of gold. He is just one part of this gigantic image that was towering in his dreams. It seems as though he's crafting an image after the image of Daniel chapter 2. And because it's so immediately on the heels thereafter, the connection is on purpose. We're not told when this happens. In fact, the only clue that we're given is in some Septuagint texts, Greek texts. There are no Hebrew texts, but some Greek texts refer to this as some 9 years later. Or maybe even up as long as 18 years. But this is some time later. This is probably after there's been some political upheaval underneath Nebuchadnezzar's rule. He's had to put down some rebellions in some of the outlying regions. And so he's experienced some threats to his kingdom at this point. But the point is that this follows on the heels of this image where he is the head of gold. But he builds this 90 by 9 tower made of pure gold. And it's interesting, he sets it up on the plain of Dura there in verse 2. This is in the land of Shinar, on the plain in the land of Shinar. The language is the same as Genesis 11. We're not told which plain. We're just told that it's a plain in Shinar. We don't know what the plain of Dura is. We don't know where that's at. But it's not in the city. It's on the plain. It's in a place where something standing up like that would draw attention and many, many, many people could see it. And we're told that the image that Nebuchadnezzar made, he set up. In fact, almost every time now, up until verse 9, the image is referenced. They came to the dedication of the image. Which image? The image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. The image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Wherever the image is announced, so is the name. Genesis 11. They built a tower and said, let us make a great name
for ourselves. It will build up to the heavens. Here's this man who has a towering image, who's establishing his own name, and he wants everyone to equate this image with him and with his kingdom. And what is he doing with this image? He's making of all peoples one. Isn't that interesting? And so he says, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, languages." Why are there languages? Because from this place, God scattered them. And Nebuchadnezzar said, "Under me, all people will be gathered together as one." Wow. You watch what's happening here, and it's almost scary. You are to fall down and worship. What will make these people one? They will be one in their worship. Worship is the vehicle by which Nebuchadnezzar seeks to unite all peoples. Now, it's probably a loyalty pledge that he's seeking, but he's bringing them together to worship. And it's interesting, as Nebuchadnezzar is introduced to us in these texts, that in chapter 2, verse 38, we see that all the beasts of the field, all the birds of the air, are under this king's domain. He reflects the creation mandate to go out and have dominion over all the earth. We see that Nebuchadnezzar somehow, ironically, fulfills that creation beginning of time mandate. We also see that Nebuchadnezzar, in forcing people to choose to worship him and deny the one real God, serves as an anti-Christ who will demand the worship of all peoples at the end of the ages. Interesting, the pictures that this one man fulfills in this call to worship. We have to learn to worship well. Because if we don't learn to worship the one true God, who's going to be at the center of our stories? We are. Now, it might not look as bold as Nebuchadnezzar, but it looks just as ugly. Me, mine, my way or the highway. We run over people. We don't throw them into physical furnaces. We just throw them out of the way so that we can have our way. If you don't learn to worship well, my friend, you will be the center of your story, and you're left erecting this tiny little pillar. It might be 90 feet tall, but it's going to be this tiny little pillar that one day is going to be smashed. If we don't learn to worship well, we're going to be prone to that primeval inclination towards self-glory. This is a big image. He makes it on the plain of Dura, all of gold, hopes that he'll do it forever. But the second point is this. As we move down just a little bit further, we see that these three Jews stand accused. And as they stand accused, we see the clarifying nature of worship. What's at stake here? At stake in our worship is our allegiance. Because we always worship something, we always worship someone. So our allegiance is at stake. Worship always draws up sides. There's insiders and there's outsiders. And so as the text develops, we see that these Chaldeans come. These are the insiders. They're either ethnic Chaldeans or they're political Chaldeans. They're the ones who are the astrologers. They're a group that are identified by this name within the Babylonian community. They're the insiders. And they come to the king and they speak of the outsiders. They said, "O king, there are certain Jews." They came to accuse the Jews. They call him the king who lives forever. And they start to bring these Jews in front of the king. And it says they maliciously accused them. And the literal rendering of that is they ate the pieces of them. They kind of points us forward to Daniel chapter 6 with the lion's den, right? These people want to consume, eat up these Jews. They know them not only by their ethnicity as the Jews, but they know them by name. These are Chaldeans who've probably been passed over by these young whippersnappers that in chapter 1 were promoted. In chapter 2 were promoted. By the end of chapter 3 will again be promoted. And these guys don't like the fact that these Jews not even homeboys, these are outsiders, have been promoted as youngsters over us who have been lifetimers here in Babylon, and they're bringing this accusation against them. They know them by name, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they're wanting to eat them up. But what we see is that worship not only draws up sides, it always has a focus. And the focus of this worship is none other than the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, some seven times in these first nine verses. And so when they come into his presence, they acknowledge the king. O king, live forever. And as they lay out this accusation against these Jews in verse 12, they make it very personal. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. We do. Long may you live. But they disregard you. They highlight this as a personal affair. Also at the center of this worship is not only the king, but the king's word. Verse 10, they remind him, O king, you have made a decree. That decree ends in a burning fiery furnace, don't forget. And let us point out that these are your opponents, these certain Jews. Oh, by the way, there are certain Jews that you have appointed. And they're probably highlighting the fact that this is a matter of ingratitude. If these people that you appoint would disregard you in this way, king, we just want to draw this to attention. We want you to be honored as you are due. You can see them just buttering up. It's just so thick. It almost chokes us as we read this. You have appointed them, and you've appointed them over the affairs of the province of Babylon, verse 12. Why has Nebuchadnezzar set up and erected this mammoth tower of a man to get all the peoples to come together and worship? He's bringing them together for a pledge of allegiance, not just to Nebuchadnezzar, but to Babylon, because we find out later that this image, we don't know if it is an image of Nebuchadnezzar or not, but it's an image of a man made of gold, and it represents the gods of the king. And so I like how one commentator said, it's probably pledging to worship the spirit of Babylon, pledging to the party of Babylon, if you will. But here you have these homeboys now. They're part of the home team. They're in the province of Babylon. And we've brought in these satraps and these governors and all these different people from all these different provinces. And they've come long distances. They've come to the province of Babylon. And all of them are commanded to bow. And who's not bowing except the ones who are right here in Babylon? King, this is your home team. You need to strip them of their jerseys, sit them on the bench. They're not only not contributing to the king's word and following the king's orders, they're not contributing to the king's program of getting everybody on the same page. These are the dissenters. These are the problem causers within all your realm. Everybody else will bow. Those in your own back door will not. This is a problem. Not only do they not follow the king's program, but they don't support the king's religion. They do not serve your gods. But that's the point, right? Because worship clarifies. You're either in because of your worship or you're out because of your worship. And they said, we will be outsiders so long as insiders are worshiping around something other than the true God. There's no other option. Jesus said the same thing. Either you're for me or you're against me. There's no third party choice when it comes to Jesus. Number three, we see the aggressive demand to compromise. So, verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commands them to be brought. There's a touch of jealousy. They what? Against me? But he is the king, he brings them in, and there's a hint of justice. He understands political intrigue. If anybody understands political intrigue, it's the king. And so he asks them in verse 14, is it true? I've heard something. I want to give you the opportunity to clear your name. Is this true? And so he gives them a hint of justice, and he gives them a pretense of grace. Now, verse 15, if you are ready to bow, well and good. This sounds so gracious, does it not? Until you read the next verse. But if you don't, let me remind you, you will burn. You do have a choice, but they're pretty few. There's a glimpse of this reality. If you do not worship, you will burn. There's really no option. And then he adds to all of this just he kind of signs his own death warrant, if you will, by giving it the exclamation at the end. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hand? Without saying so much, the presupposition is this: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I hold your life in my hand. I am God in your life. And what God will dethrone me because I hold your very life in my hand? And aggressively, he presses his advantage, the advantage of authority, the advantage of his position, the advantage of his wealth, the advantage of all the people that are surrounding him, and he demands them to compromise. And we find so often that we bend, we bow because of the aggressive nature, the aggressive force to compromise. But we see there in the middle that in their faith, they're inflexible. And in fact, faith is inflexible. If faith flexes, it's not faith. If faith bends, it's called compromise. Faith, in order to be faith, must be inflexible. Not necessarily defiant, but definitive. Now, there's been one definitive choice that they've already made thus far in the story. Chapter 1, Daniel purposed in his heart not to defile himself. But we also see that that choice applies to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It seems that they, along with Daniel, made the choice long ago not to defile themselves. In fact, put us to the test. They were willing to be tested in light of their commitment. That's the choice. They already made it. We stand with God. They did it at this level back in the day. And they passed the test. They were faithful with a little. God gives them more to be faithful with. Now there's two very distinct commands. Command number one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Pretty simple. Command number two, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is under heaven above, in the heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. They said, what did he say? What did he mean? What will we do? What he said, that's what we do. What he said, that's what we do. That's the determination. And they answer the king with four definitive statements. Verse 16, there's no need to answer. What God is there? We know. Number two, our God is able. Verse 18, we will not serve. Verse 19, we will not worship. There's not a lot of room for compromise with these guys. They're pretty inflexible. They're not very open-minded. They really don't tolerate this intolerable king. Isn't it interesting? The toleration only works one way. You stand up to the toleration, and you're intolerable. And he will depose them. But understand this. This is where they are defined. Whose allegiance will you pledge? Will you pledge allegiance to this God, or will you pledge allegiance to this God? They draw the line. Faith forces them to draw the line. Worship forces them to draw the line. And what we find out is that we must learn to worship well, because faith is always a worship matter. Faith is always a worship matter. Whenever I don't exercise faith, it's because my God on my throne is too small. It's because I have the wrong God on that throne. When I don't exercise faith, it's because I'm loving something other than the one true living God. I have something else on his throne. And worship helps me to understand the inflexible nature of my faith. On the backside of this, we find then that the king is again enraged. And we find that those who surround the king and are obedient to the king and are trusting in the king for their own welfare, they end up losing their life. And we see the tragic cost of misplaced obedience. So Nebuchadnezzar now is filled with fury. The expression of his image is the word. His image now is changed, and he orders the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. These furnaces were heated for bricks. They were probably brick kilns. They probably helped to smelt the gold that went into this statue. They were heated, history tells us, up to about 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, about 1,000 degrees Celsius. They were fed with charcoal in order to get them hotter. They would just pitch in the pitch or the bitumen and just make it hot. So they didn't have things that could measure, is it 7 times hotter? It's as hot as it can get. Make it as hot as it can get. And so he orders, verse 20, he orders some of his mighty of his army. He has this emotional response. He intensifies the punishment, and he makes an intentional selection. Get some of the mighty men of my army. These aren't just the common schmuck, okay? These are the special forces. These are the men of the throne, if you will. And so he taps them and says, "You, whoever's wearing the trident, you bind them and bring them down to this kiln and throw them in the fire." And they do. They bind them, the biggest, roughest, toughest guys in all the kingdom. I mean, these are the best of the best. They have pledged loyalty to the king, and they've pledged it with their lives. And what does it cost them? Their life. Because on a whim, the king says, "I hate them so much, bind them and take them." And it costs him his best men. It costs him his bodyguard. It costs him his most loyal followers who have pledged to give their lives for his welfare. And he throws their lives away. But here's the thing. Every time we chase down a false god, it always promises, "Have this with my love." And the whole time, that God, that false God, is more than willing to throw your life away. Why don't you just taste this fruit? It's so good. It'll make you wise. It'll make you like God. It will cost you your life. It will cost you your life. That's the tragic cost of misplaced obedience, of misplaced worship. But we see that in the end of verse 23, they fall down bound into the fire. It looks like there's a victory. Chalk one up for Nebi. Nope. The next verse, we're not told what happens. Now all of a sudden we're looking at life through the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar is astonished. King Nebuchadnezzar gets up off his throne. King Nebuchadnezzar's in a hurry. King Nebuchadnezzar turns to his counselors and says, "Listen, didn't we cast 3 men bound into the fire?" And they said, "Yes, king, yep, that's right. You counted right. 1, 2, 3. And he answers, verse 25, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire. And they are not hurt. My plans have failed.
I forget one of those stupid old cartoons used to watch way back as a kid.
Choices foiled again, right? You just hear Nebuchadnezzar, stink, it didn't work. I thought I was God of their lives. I threatened them with everything that my kingdom has to destroy, and it's empty. It's worthless. It didn't work. Bring in the kryptonite. I didn't have the biggest, best, baddest tools to get rid of these guys. And so as he's counting up this, what we find is that what began as a challenge demanding a response from the Jews became not just a challenge against the Jews, it became a challenge against their God. But now all of a sudden the tables are turned, because the one who thought himself to be God sees that he's not. And now there's going to be a challenge against him. What is he going to do with this? Finding out that there's somebody bigger than him. And we see there that there's a fourth man in the fire. Verse 25. The appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. We don't know who this is, whether it's an angel or if it's the person of Jesus Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ. I would lean toward the person of Christ. Because the good shepherd, Psalm 23 says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? Because thou art with me. And so oftentimes, as God's people have been thrust into fiery furnace situations, who's been there with them to walk through the Red Sea? None other than their God. Who is there with them in order to walk them through the flames? None other than their God. But here's the thing. God didn't take them out of the flames. God went into the flames with them. God didn't take them out of the flames. They were called out of the flames, but he preserved them through the flames. And what's clarified by their salvation is that there is a God, and you're not it, Nebuchadnezzar. And so often, God wants to use our lives and say, I want them to see that there is a God. And I say, God, I don't want to go in the furnace. God, that furnace is hot. Take me away from the furnace. And God says, but I want them to see. I want to clarify who I am by using you so I can save you, so I can preserve you, so I can show my power through you being obedient and trusting. But it hurts. But it's scary. But I'm God. I wonder if so often we don't forfeit the opportunity to impact people in our lives because we have such small prayers that say, God, take away the flames, or at least turn down the heat in my life. God, don't make me go to a place that requires salvation. Let's be reasonable about this. Let's think this through. But what God is doing is nothing less than a work of salvation as he clarifies who he is in the world. And then we find that Nebuchadnezzar makes this royal decree now to all nations. And he brings things, again, in a paradoxical way. He's bringing things to the end of the story. One day, every knee will bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth. And every tongue will confess what? Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. One day, all nations and peoples and tongues will confess the one true God as the only God. And Nebuchadnezzar say, don't you dare speak against this God. And then he underlines it again now with the fleshly power that he has. Or I'll kill you. Or I'll kill you. Because there's no God who can do what this God has done with his people. As we've worked through this story, what we've seen is that worship is nothing less than a life and death matter. We don't look at it that way. But what you worship will bring you to a destination, because those who worship them become like them. They learn to trust in them. But here's another point I want us to see. Worship will only be a matter of death in your life when worship has become a way of life. Sometimes we don't realize it, but God entrusts martyrdom to those who he can entrust with martyrdom. And I wonder if sometimes we're not passed over for the big assignment because we cashed in way back on the earlier assignment and said, God, this is too big, I'm going to buckle. And we're not faithful with that which is little, because worship isn't a way of life. So we're not even threatened with worship becoming a way of death, because we weren't even faithful with that which was little. And so I ask you this morning, how are you evidencing faith as a follower of the one true God? Where are you refusing to bow where the world's bowing around you? Where are you willing to step out by faith in obedience, regardless or despite the consequences? What does faith look like in your life? Remember, as we come to this table, why do we come to this table? Because there is one who counted his life not unto death, who though he was God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. And he says to all who will follow him, if any would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me.